comes the most significant moment of the film. We have seen Mrs. Fraser, the lady of the manor, reproach herself for not taking Nora's warning seriously. All in all, the Toffs have not acquitted themselves well during this film. It is up to Mrs. Fraser to redeem her class. This she does by exerting leadership, ensuring that the children in her care in the manor house are kept away from the windows, and that the eldest is charged with raising their morale. She is in the middle of exhorting her charges when a hand grenade bounces onto the carpet of the room in which they are gathered. Without hesitation, she picks it up and runs from the room with it, slamming the door behind her. She is blown to smithereens off camera.
All safe and sound?
Yes, thank you, Mrs. Fraser.
Well, George got to Upton all right.
Good old George.
When are the soldiers coming?
They'll be here any moment now.
I wish they were here now.
Oh, she's yellow.
However many times one watches that scene, or even the entire film, that moment remains profoundly shocking. This is what the upper classes were always meant to do. It is what one has read in the posthumous commendations of so many men of Mrs. Fraser's class and generation who, a quarter century before the film was made, died on the Western Front. It is a forceful comment by Ealing on the classlessness that war should impose. The other heroes of the film, except the poor vicar and his slow-on-the-uptake daughter, are NCOs and other ranks. The able seaman masterminds the plan to start the rebellion against the Germans, assisted by the publican, the verger, and the policeman. It is a Cockney evacuee, helped by the village poacher, who escapes from the manor house and, though wounded by a German bullet, gets to the next village to raise the alarm. Mrs. Fraser upholds officer class values. The Wilsfords of this world, so reminiscent of the class that toyed before the war with that nice Mr. Ribbentrop, the Mitfords, and Moseleys, and Londonderrys, the former King Edward VIII, and his fantasies of being reinstalled on the British throne, and the casual anti-Semitism and snobbery that so many of them seem to harbour, get what was coming to them. If there is a way forward that means neither a return to the poverty and deprivation of the 1930s, nor a diversion into Moseleyite authoritarianism, it is one in which the workers, the NCOs and the other ranks, must play their full part. I have to concede it is rash to say that Mrs. Fraser's running out of the room with a hand grenade was a necessary step on the road to the election of the Attlee government in 1945, but there is a sort of logic to it. Her act was certainly one born of generations of breeding, but it was also one that signalled the new reality, made clear not least by the hideous casualty rates among the officer class in the Great War, that war is a common enterprise across social divisions. The cushioned life that the upper and upper middle classes were thought to have during the peace, and in many cases did have, gave them no right to be shielded in war from unpleasant work, as they were, or were thought to be, in peace. This was a way to a wider and deeper democracy, in which everyone had an equal share. If one reads the reminiscences of those who worked at Ealing in these years, the testament is that the ethos at the studios was a socialist one. It was not just that so much there was a team effort, something that rankled with and finally drove away directors such as Robert Hamer, for whom individualism was more important, but that the writers and directors there, working under the aegis of the studio's boss, Michael Balkan, were determined to drop hints about and argue for the creation of the New Jerusalem through their cinematic craft. Although Went the Day Well is a film about repelling a German invasion, the theme was out of date even when the film was in production. Few imagined, after Operation Barbarossa in June 1941, when Hitler's armies invaded the Soviet Union, that he was going to have the luxury of sparing the resources to come across the Channel and invade Britain. The film was released in the week of Al-Alamein, which finally turned the tide of the war. The messages it sent to its audience were not about resisting the invader, but about forming a coherent modern society on principles that did not include automatic deference within a near-feudal social order. By 1944, with the Second Front opened, Ealing allowed itself a glimpse of the socialist utopia with a literal, stagey and frankly unsuccessful film of J.B. Priestley's play They Came to a City, about the ideal community people would build in the New Jerusalem. Yet few films better embody the intended post-war spirit, and the confirmation of the nobility of the other ranks and the working classes, than the 1943 Gainsborough film Millions Like Us. It has gritty reality and an absence of glamour, despite having one of the great female stars of the era, Patricia Rock, in the lead role. Celia, played by Rock, is one of yet another cross-section of civilians, all women, sent to an arms factory to do their bit for the war effort. Despite disappointment at the lack of excitement of their job, the girls all knuckle down. Celia meets a young airman, played by Gordon Jackson, whom she marries. With ghastly inevitability, he becomes one of the Bomber Command boys who never came back. The end of the film is stunning in its restraint and its message of noble determination. Celia is summoned to the Lady Superintendent's office to hear some news, news whose nature we know when the door opens to show an RAF chaplain in uniform and dog collar. We then see Celia back at her rooms, unvisited by hysteria, coming to terms with her loss. Moments later, we return to the factory, where Celia and her comrades are having their evening meal in the cavernous works canteen, while an entertainer leads community singing. She breaks into "There Was I, Waiting at the Church." Celia's friend at her right hand senses the tragedy of the moment. Without hesitation, she and the girl on the other side link arms with a young widow and jolly her into singing along with them, which Celia does with a sudden radiance in her face. It is one of the most choking moments in the British cinema, an absolute proof that we really were, at last, all in it together.
That was Simon Heffer with the first of his essays on British cinema of the 1940s. On Thursday evening this week, he'll be talking about the 1944 classic The Small Back Room. The series, produced by B.T. Rubens, was first broadcast last September. This is BBC Radio 3. Well, my apologies, we're running about 7 minutes late this evening. Those musically generous Pittsburghers in the live prom earlier on. Now, if you've been following the Mercury Prize coverage on the BBC this evening, you'll know that one of this year's nominated artists was the composer and producer John Hopkins for his collaboration with the singer King Creosote. John Hopkins is the guest in our special edition of Late Junction Now, presented by Nick Luscombe. And we join it with a new track from that collaboration between John Hopkins and King Creosote.
Blindfolded, holding the tail. You pushed and you're panning, yet you're destined to fail. For you suffered three rounds of the fight, a cut to the eyebrow, a hook to the right, a jab to the temple, you're back on the ropes, smooth at the folds. Not for a lyric amend, a stab at the start, contrite at the end. And those are honest words. It's the first time all the lies untold, waiting to choke them way down in my throat. Those are honest words. It's the first time all the lies untold, waiting to choke them way down in my throat. Those are honest words. It's the first time all the lies I've told, waiting to choke them way down in my throat. Those are honest words. Out a lyric descent, rewrote the start.
Yeah. That's music from one of the undisputed keyboard kings of his generation, Jackie Mattoo, founding member of the Scatterlights and musical director of Jamaica's Studio One record label. That was Black Organ. And before that, King Creosote and my guest, John Hopkins, Honest Words. When's that coming out, by the way?
It's the 19th of September on vinyl and download, I think.
OK, great stuff. Yeah, Jackie Mattoo, he started playing when he was four, apparently. I just wondered, when did you actually start performing and when did you start creating your own music, you know?
It was a weirdly early age. I don't know, my parents bought me this little toy xylophone thing when I was about two, and I started bashing things on that as they could see I was a bit into it. And I think when I was about five, we got a little kind of starter piano thing, and I just started playing around, really. Just started improvising, just really enjoying it. I started having lessons when I was about seven. I didn't really want to, but I think, you know, they felt it was a good idea, and I guess it was ultimately, because, I got quite into the classical side after that as a kind of diversion from, you know, what I was really interested in, which was writing and stuff.
Yeah, and how did your writing develop from that point? I mean, did you start writing at that early age?
I guess improvisations that I did when I was that young kind of turned into pieces, and I remember, like, I used to make little cassette recordings, and we got a kind of second-hand, like, Porter Studio four-track tape thing. I guess it would have been about 9 or 10, and then I had a home keyboard and just started layering things up and was obsessed with the fact that you could record one part and then rewind and then record something else on top of it. Just seemed amazing. Yeah. Still seems quite fun, actually.
Have you still got any of those recordings?
No. I think there are some of the pure piano ones from, like, when I was, you know, a bit younger than that. But the earliest electronic things I've got recorded, like, when I was 14, and they're pretty unlistenable. I was listening to a lot of Prodigy, as you do when you're 14. In fact, as you do when you're 32, like I am now. And so they're very ravey, and but just produced really weirdly. When I was like, stuff I did when I was 16, I can handle listening to that. It's kind of very 8-bit sounding, but kind of interesting in some sort of way. It wouldn't be listening to anyone but me, I should say. not it's never going to be heard by anyone but me.
Good to see the progression, so you can just keep checking back to see, you know, where you came from. So.
Yes, daily.
Okay, so I'm going to hand over to you now. You've got a piece of music from Balam Akab, right?
Yeah, this is amazing. A track called OY. And I heard this guy last year. There was an EP called Seabirds EP. S-E-E, birds, and it's just got this amazing sound. It's very rare that an electronic artist comes along who I think genuinely has their own sound world, and this guy does. I was reading a bit about him. He just kind of scours the internet for random little sound snippets and then builds these beautiful worlds from them. It's just got that slight hint of disturbingness as well, which I think is really important to, you know, keep the balance and stop things getting too sweet. So, yeah, this is an amazing track.
Thank you. Yes.
So two choices from my guest here at Late Junction, John Hopkins, Bala Macabre to start with, track called OY, and then you just heard Juk Juk. First time I've heard that. Yeah, tell me about that track.
Yeah, it's amazing. I just so it's on Kieran Hebden, aka Fortet's label, Text Records. And as I understand it, he had heard, I don't know whether he knew the guy before, but he'd heard the track and loved it and played it out at Plastic People, and then asked the guy if he just loved it. It went down so well, he just asked the guy if he could release it himself.
And as we listened to that in the studio, you were picking out little details, and you know, I love that you were really guiding me through the record. It's a beautiful piece of music, but I love the fact that you were picking out bits, and also, you know, as a good reference point to kind of tracks that you might be developing yourself as well.
Well, it's got some elements that I've been interested in for a while, like the way that that track has all these tiny little vocal cuts in it, and all these little snippets of, I don't know where it comes from, what it is, but at no point does that track sit still. There's no, you know, the beat is on a loop, kind of, but there's lots of subtle changes, but the vocal thing under it is always changing. So it's like a constant flowing thing. Never gets lazy, and the, you know, the bass bit in the middle is so unexpected. It's like, it sounds like the way it kind of overwhelms the track for a bit. It's amazing, because then when it disappears again, you just feel like you've been freed from some sort of, you know, really claustrophobic section of the song. So it's amazing. It's got that real contrast and weirdness about it. Yeah, it's great.
My next choice is from a band called The Necks from Sydney, who you've worked with before, right? When you did a performance with Brian Eno and Leo Abrahams as well.
Yes, and Carl Hyde, actually. It was, it was an amazing day that was in the Sydney Opera House. And we were lucky enough to play with The Necks. And yeah, I mean, three of the best musicians I've ever heard, really. It's just, they're like operators, one unit, the three of them. It's just, it's like one entity. It's, yeah, incredible.
And how did you improvise with them? Is that how it worked? Mm. Or how did the performance take
it was, place? Yeah. I mean, we'd done like a day of rehearsal where we all sat around and kind of came up with a whole load of ideas, none of which were used in the actual show. And it's completely improvised. I mean, The Necks only improvise. They have no, that's just all they do. And then we kind of, Carl would have a few vocal ideas that he would bring back, but yeah, it was just totally freeform. You know, we hit on things that we liked, because it was three shows in a row, so we do like three separate hour shows with half an hour gap between, and there were some things that worked so well in the first and second show that we just kind of kept doing them. Brian would be in charge of who's playing and who isn't playing. There would always be a section where he tells everyone else to shut up apart from The Necks. We just literally hold up a sign which says Necks only. And then they would just go down to those three guys, and they would just build something incredible just with the three instruments, just piano, double bass and drums. It's just phenomenal to watch. Thank you.
That's music from John Hopkins, a track called A Drifting Down. And it's great to have John in the Lake Junction studio. You can tell me about that track and not why you chose it, but it's the first time I've heard it. But you can tell me about maybe how you put that together.
I will tell you why I chose it as well, because I just think it is probably the only time in the world that piece will ever be played on the radio. So it's a companion piece to a track on Insides, my last album. The album track was called A Drifting Up, and this is called A Drifting Down. And this is basically an extension of those ideas, which just took away all the percussive elements. And it starts out as a string piece with Erskine Creosote's humming in the background. And I really firstly wanted to create this idea of, like, someone's humming to themselves and they don't know anyone's listening. It's not really the point. They're just singing quietly to themselves. And then I kind of had it panned hard to the right so that when you listen to it in your room, it actually sounds like someone is just humming in your ear almost.
Yeah.
Not in a sort of nasty way. But there was this kind of really intimate quality that I thought that gave. And I was trying to recreate an experience I had where I was at a party and I was lying on this bed and I was kind of, it was really late and I was just kind of falling asleep. And there were two girls, there's one sitting on either side of me, and they were talking to each other. And I was half asleep and I just remember, as I kind of went down, and I was kind of like half dreaming, and I kind of I just remember the sound of their voices coming as if they were coming from miles away, and I just really had this urge to try and recreate that feeling. It was so atmospheric hearing these kind of soft female voices, and so I got some people in to just record. I kind of recorded some talking, and mixed it very quietly into the track.
And what about the ending as well? You were talking as we were listening to that you had a dictaphone on a piano, and that's a real rain sound. And
because I mean, when you have a track that's like that slow and it's really in no rush to grab you or to, it's a real drifting thing. So I thought at the end, rather than just let the strings die out, I just had this idea for a kind of little piano thing. And I'd finished the rest of the track and I was just listening back to it, and I just, as I was listening to it, I had the idea. So I just pressed record. I've always got a dictaphone ready to record. I just pressed record and it picked up all the rain that was outside, and it was this really atmospheric autumn day, and just so that's a kind of live recording that just got stuck on the end of the song, basically.
Great, yeah, really good to hear that track. Well, I've got a track now, but I'm not going to say who it's by. I just want you to listen to it. I'm just curious to know what you think.
Okay, cool.
It's Late Juncture with me, Nick Luscombe, and my guest, John Hopkins. Music from Steve Moore. Do you like that?
Yeah, it's lovely, yeah.
So that's, I mean, I first heard that, I must admit, I was checking the date on the sleeve, but that's actually new. That's like a new record.
Oh, that's
on Static Caravan, yeah.
Oh, is it?
So
oh,
to wow. me, that was...
I guess 1991 when I heard it.
Back even further, you know, but when we were talking, when we were listening, you were explaining how some of the production on that could only be, you know, 90s onwards, really, which is interesting.
Yeah, something in the sort of delays and stuff in the background, I thought they might struggle with the tape stuff in the 70s, but I wouldn't have... Yeah, that's a lovely piece of music, that's great.
Actually, while we're talking about kind of keyboards and synths, you know, you can get geeky with us if you like. I mean, tell us what you use in the studio. What are your favourite,
I'm trying to change everything at the moment because I need to start writing a new record and I don't want to have pretty much anything I've had before used on the new one. But previously, the last record was all done with SoundForge on a PC, which is usually just a sound editor, not something people use for music that much, but I've just been addicted to it for years. And just recording Korg Trinity, which is a sort of early 90s keyboard that I love and no one else seems to love. But I've just got so many sounds on it over the years that I love. I just know exactly what I'm doing with it. That and the piano, and then I would record the piano in and manipulate the piano to, you know, just in any kind of different way. Like a lot of the things that sound like pads or, you know, choral sounds or any of that kind of, that's all comes from the piano, just manipulated in various ways. And then the drums would often be me drumming on things, which, again, we processed and... but for the next record, I want to actually get some synths, so get like a Korg MS-20, which is a classic 70s analog number, and maybe some Moog stuff. I don't know yet, but we'll see. Just to have some new things to play with to start the record, just to really kick start things off.
To me, your production sound quite organic, quite warm sounding. There's definitely a human sort of creating that music, and then you're using your equipment to kind of transfer that. Whereas a lot of other artists perhaps will kind of get quite sort of heavy with the technology and use that to kind of create the music.
Mm.
Would you say you're kind of, you prefer the former of those two?
Well, I think my stuff is melody led, which means it always is always going to come down to this, you know, the actual notes that are being played. And I don't really have the ability to make purely rhythmic music. I haven't really tried, you know. But I think, it's just that and instinct, following instinct, really.
Okay, next music, from me, actually. Sorry, I'm hogging a little bit here, but
that's great.
Two tracks coming up. One from Dorothy Ashby in just a moment. Before that, John Hassell, produced by Brian Eno and Daniel Lenoir, as we were together looking at the record sleeve. This is Power Spot.
Thank you. For some we loved, the loveliest and the best, and from his vintage rolling time of crest, have drunk their cup a round or two before, and one by one crept silently to rest. One by one crept silently to rest.
It's Late Junction with Meenit Luscombe and my guest musician and producer John Hopkins. Music from two American musicians, each experimenting with Asian and African sounds. Jazz harpist Dorothy Ashby there from the Rubaiyat of Dorothy Ashby, released in 1970, and she's playing the Japanese koto. The album also features oboe, violin and kalimba. And before that, trumpeter John Hassell with a title track from the 1986 ECM release Power Spot, produced, as I said, by Brian Eno and Daniel Lenoir. John, going back to your kind of classical influences, what did your classical kind of training involve?
It was specifically on the piano, really, just to... I got really into playing. I just met a really good teacher. Went to the Royal College of Music on Saturdays at the same time as school from, like, 13 to 17, and got really inspired by a teacher called Emily Jeffrey. And she just... I really wasn't that interested in learning the piano until that point. It was kind of something parents had not forced, but kind of made me do. There's any difference between those two things, which is ultimately for the best because I ended up with better finger technique and I ended up getting exposed to a lot of amazing music. Ravel specifically, I used to play a lot of Ravel and just absolutely loved it. So I imagine it kind of rubbed off on what I started writing myself. But it all kind of ended really when I was 16. I won this competition, which meant that I had to play. Really didn't think this through at the time. It meant that I would have to play Ravel's piano concerto with a full orchestra. And it's just the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life. Because classical performances, you know, you sit there in tails, looking ridiculous as a 16-year-old. And it's just utter silence in the place. And, you know, I couldn't stand the pressure of it, really. So I just did that one performance and then didn't pursue it much after that. That kind of showed me that it wasn't something I ever wanted to relive. And then I saw the film Shine, which bizarrely had the freak out that he has at the piano is in the same concert hall on the same piano.
Okay.
And with the same conductor. So it felt like I was a little bit too close to just going a bit weird. So I retreated from that into the world of bedroom tronica.
You've chosen a track from Smog next. Tell me why you chose this one.
This is off one of my favourite albums of all time, A River Ain't Too Much to Love. Smog, yeah, just incredible voice. No one sounds like that, really. And this particular song it's just got hilarious lyrics as usual, very dry, but it's incredibly peaceful to listen to. I think it's a sort of vague tale about moving out into the country, and but there's a whole load of, there's all kinds of other stuff going on in there. But it just gets calmer and calmer throughout, and by the end when he's talking about, I think it's this line about moving to the country and never again having to wonder, did that rapper rape her? This brilliant kind of newspaper headline that he just doesn't want to hear anymore. It's amazing.
On the bed in the dark, laughing at things I think of. Getting off on the pornography of my past. Lighting matches and dropping them into a wet glass. It's summer now and it's hot, and the sweat pours out. And the air is the same as my body. Breathe my body inside out. With sunlight around, my skin turns brown, and you wouldn't know me from your pa or Adam or Allah. But I haven't changed. No, I haven't changed. Day is all that resolves. All we need is here on earth. About every other.
scratch marks on my knees since I've been running the Bramble Lee. The Bramble Lee. Oh, 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 the Bramble Lee. Oh, 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 the Bramble Lee. When I'd much rather be wanting to be running the loping. Peace on your hand, don't be silly. Put peace in my body when tired and beaten. All we need is here on earth. About every other day. Other things where the hills loping, where the dress and the hair in the river undulating. To take a wife and no paper. Never again to wonder, did that rapper rape her? All we need is here on earth, about every here on earth, about every other day.
The sound of the leaves when my feet bounce around. tip tapping, tip tapping in the dark, tip tapping, hours tip tapping, tip tapping in the dark in the bar. The sound of the leaves on my feet hit the ground, the sound of the leaves on my feet bounce around in the dark. The sound of the leaves when my feet hit the ground, the sound of the leaves when my feet bounce around in the dark in the bar. Tip tapping, hours tip tapping, tip tapping in the dark.
So that's music from Dylan that it's been released on B Pitch Control, which I kind of know for sort of quite techno-related music, but something a bit different. Yeah. What do you think of that, John?
That was beautiful, yeah. Yeah, very good. I would never have guessed that label.
No.
Kind of Paul Kalkbrenner and Apparat and things like that from Mode Selector, and that's what I'm familiar with. That's when I think of that label, but that was really great, really charming.
Before that, Smog, Running the Loping. That was your choice. And another of yours coming up from Bruce Langhorn, which leads very nicely to talk about soundtracks and the things that you've worked on and how your approach differs really from, to making your every other sort of many productions and tracks.
Well, it's easier for many reasons, because you just, the main focus of people's attention is already there. The film is there. So you're just, you're kind of a component of something rather than the whole thing. Which it's really inspiring. If the film is good, which I thought Monsters was, amazing, then it really just kind of writes itself. You're looking at this incredible cinematography and these great performances, and you just literally be looking at the screen and playing and recording and just kind of editing that, really.
I mean, when you're making your own music that's not soundtrack, do you think visually anyway, or
no, not at all? No. They're really abstract. They're just kind of ideas I've got in my head, or I'm again just following instinct, not thinking about this is about a thing. I might realize later that it is in fact about something, but at the time, no, there's no images at all. That's the other reason I love to, if I write a piece for a film, it will forever be totally bound up with that image, and I like that.
So you still enjoy the challenge of a good soundtrack? Is it something that really appeals? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not set out to do any more in the immediate future, but this Bruce Langhorn one was for a film called The Hired Hand, which is a Peter Fonda film. Which I was just saying to you, I've never met anyone who's ever seen it, but the soundtrack is just an absolute legend. I mean, it's incredible. But apparently, the final recording, there was some sort of tape delay, which makes it sound, I think there's a delay all the way through the album. Like everything you hear twice in quick succession. And the guy was like horrified, and then it turned out that everyone loved that sound, and it's sort of went down as it went down like that, really. Thank you.
traveling through this world of woe. Here there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I'm going there to see my father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over home.
I think that's pretty much my favourite recording of all time. Emmylou Harris, her take on the traditional wayfaring stranger. And before that, from the original score from the 1971 film The Hired Hand, composed and performed by Bruce Langhorne. There's a whole generation of music fans, I think, that have heard the Jamie Woon version of Wayfaring Stranger rather than that version. Obviously, there are many more before that. And then the remix by Burial as well. Just wondered, you know, we've talked about your soundtracks, you know, we talked about, you know, various bits that you've worked on, but we haven't talked about remixes. Is that something that is it necessary or something you love doing?
Oh, I love it, absolutely. It's a chance to write in a... For me, it's like a chance to make music in a totally different genre from... Like, there's been some really random different ones in the recent years, like Wild Beasts, and then this David Lynch one I did, which was quite amazing experience, and then Agoria. So anything from kind of trance and techno to weird kind of blues.
You've got some... three tracks coming up now, all quite different from each other, starting off with Neutral Milk Hotel. Do you want to tell us a little bit about
this? Well, this is actually from my favourite album of all time. This was, I guess, kind of one of the main influences behind Diamond Mine, which people who've heard both albums will not believe or understand why I would say that, but because Neutral Milk Hotel album In the Aeroplane Over the Sea is very kind of loud and punky in places, but it's all seamlessly, it's one long piece, really. You have to be listening to the whole thing in one go, and there's no gaps between the tracks. It's a kind of concept album. It's got moments just of incredible beauty and then real fierceness, and all tied together with some sort of weird obsession with Anne Frank. And this song is called Communist Daughter. I won't say anything about the lyrics, really, but there's something really hypnotic about it. I think he was recording bits of shortwave radio static and looping them over the top. It's just got such a sound to it. It's incredible.
as chosen by my guest John Hopkins. That's Clark with Taycan. And before that, Clams Casino with Waterfalls. And you also heard Neutral Milk Hotel with Communist Daughter. Three very different sounding records. Yeah, tell us about the Clams Casino. How do you think that differs from Clark? And
It's interesting that I don't really know much about that guy or girl, assuming it's a guy. We don't know where he's from. Or
Clams
anything,
Casino, but, yeah, complete yeah. mystery, yeah.
Yeah, it's got an amazing atmosphere to it. It's extremely kind of lo-fi. There's no kind of big studio sound there, and that's massively part of its charm. And then when you hear the Chris Clark track, it's expertly produced to the point of perfection. So equally brilliant in a different way. It's just nice to hear them together like that. And the beat that comes in halfway through that Clark track is just insane. I love it.
It's a beautiful piece of music, isn't it? And we've got time for just a few more, not very many, which is we've got a big list to get through. But
a whole load of stuff.
We're going to listen to one of your remixes now. We talked about remixes earlier, but we haven't heard this yet. James Yorkston with Woozy with Cider. Tell me about this track and how you met up with James Yorkston.
Yeah, well, I guess through the Fence Collective thing, through King Caruso, and then this track was a bit of a departure for James because it's spoken word, and the version on the album had the music behind it was by a guy called Reporter. So it was a chance to just write a new piece of music behind using the same lyric or spoken word stuff. And I just found that as soon as if you change the music behind it, it just the words seem to take on a completely different meaning. And there's a real... So I just put this really simple piano motif behind it and a story about him and him, where he lives and what he's doing. It just became really nostalgic. And, it was an interesting experience.
Watching the park quieten from the hotel window, I hear you softly sleep amongst the cars and saluting songbirds. For a city whose size had scared me for years, right now it's a feeble evening roar, not unsimilar to a beach evening ending. On the table to my left, there's a magazine with a picture of a dead monkey, making a mockery of what I'd call art. But what would I know about the scene in this city that has swallowed up friends, lovers, and family? Just give me a village the size of a teacup. But you're happier here, spread out with your eyes closed. I feel I should order a drink in celebration to welcome the summer whose first day is ending. But should you wake, you'd catch me, of course, and ask me the wisdom of drinking once more. Back to yesterday's wedding, when we got drunk and fell over. I did my best to be polite to a family I'd never met, but on numerous occasions, I guess I could have tried harder. Of course, by the end of the night, I was best friends with everyone and everyone's wife. But right now, I can remember their names no matter how hard I tried. As the sun glares through the hotel window, I wonder of our future and where it'll lead to. I wonder if you'll be laying there 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the line. I'll still be staring out at the street, confused about love and life. It'll be interesting to see if anyone ever bought those songs of mine, if anyone heard those words that I never got quite right. I think I can be honest in presuming the world is not exactly going to be leaping out of his bed to make me rich, using my songs in adverts, selling oranges. Or lemons. As I may end up owning the whole street, or more likely, sleeping under a tree in the park opposite. Would the runners keep me awake, or would I keep them asleep? I hope I'd have the sense to move back home, as lovely as today is. I imagine the winter would be rather cold. I've been told for years that the devil had the best tunes, and that the devil lived down here, whereas us country folk weren't worth the salt from the road, from expat magazine editors who chose to lose their temper on the easily persuaded northern town dwellers. And sure enough, 99% of the people I meet have scant regard for entertaining me. It seems I'm too old and too slow and too quiet and just wrong. Well, I'm glad. In their cocaine-fueled electronic cabarets, I'll be the man at the bar drinking overpriced whiskey from a barmaid who's too good to catch my eye. As she only works here two nights a week, the rest of the time she's a singer in a rock and roll change her tune if I told her my album had peaked at number 172. That I also had friends who worked in bars, and that didn't define who they are, though it certainly helps their capacity to drink. But I've strayed off the subject, and now I'll be leaning over and waking you up, and you'll squint at me through the cracks between your eyelids, woozy with cider, as if you're asking just exactly where we are and exactly what I wanted. And I'll be happy, as we won't be taking anything too seriously.
Come out the shoulder, 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 come to show them, come out, come out 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 to show them, 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 come out to
like open the blues up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them. I had to like open the blues up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them.
Two really nice remixes there. James Yorkston, Woozy with Cider remix by John Hopkins. And then you just heard Ken Ishii remixing Come Out by Steve Reich. John, what's the key to a great remix, do you think?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, I've never made one that's, it really depends what your categories are. If it's a dance track, then, yeah, it's all about rhythm. But I think it's a completely open platform, really. You can just do anything. You know, it's just a new piece of music, really, a remix. So it should follow the rules of any other piece of music. It should be good.
Sure, yeah. I mean, with the James Yorkston remix, how did you technically do that? Did you just had the vocal to work with? Or?
Oh, I had all the parts for the music as well, but I just wanted to do something different. James had also sent me this, I think it's in the original, but there's a lot of field recording in the background, which I think is just city, like background city noise. And I've been obsessed with field recordings and using them in music for ages. And it's all over Diamond Mine. It's like just sounds of where we were. And, you know, I like to stick the mics out the window in my studio and use that a lot in my own stuff. And so maybe that remix might have been the first time I got involved in that. I'm not sure.
Great. Well, we got one more track from Mickey Newbury. Introduce this one if you could.
So this guy is, I don't know that much about him, but I mean, I think he died about 10 years ago, but this I think is from either the late 60s or early 70s. He was someone who wrote a lot of Elvis's most famous songs, but his own voice, criminally underlooked. I think he's got the most incredible voices ever, really. I think there is a cult following going on out there somewhere, but I first heard it a few years ago before it had even been reissued on vinyl, and I just think it's a heartbreaking piece of music, really.
Well, thanks for listening to this Late Junction special with my guest, John Hopkins. And thanks, John, for joining me in the studio today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. It's been great fun.
It's been great to hear your selections. And this is Mickey Newbury.
¶¶ pressed to glass. The dew is like a broken diamond necklace left scattered on the grass. She slipped from my side. She stands at the window and watches the rain. Lord, I wish I was blind and could not read her mind and see all her pain. But from here where I lie, I can see the tears in her eyes as she quietly cries out for him, not for me. How many times must the piper be paid for his song? Her shattered dream, it's like broken glass cutting through to her soul. It's leaving her naked man alone now to tremble and cry in the cold. Any day now she knows that he'll call. Lord, she's wondering if I'll be around when he times must the piper be paid for his song. Well, the sun fell through the window, the morning was filled with the singing of birds. Will she ever remember he sung the songs but forgot all the words? From here where I lie, tears in her eyes as she quietly cries, then she turns and she walks back to me. How many times must the piper be paid for his song?
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3 Through the Night with me, Jonathan Swain. Joseph Haydn and his pupil Beethoven for this couple of hours. A couple of symphonies, the young Beethoven second and Haydn's number 73, the one nicknamed The Hunt. But for Haydn lovers, there's also a chance to hear three of his early and very seldom played keyboard trios, all of them dating from the 1760s or even earlier, which for a late developer like Haydn means pre-puberty. It's a recent concert from Budapest with harpsichordist Scholt Bolok, violinist Daniel Popp and cellist George Dayak. Here, first of all, in Haydn's trio number 7, a piece with a particularly florid and spacious third movement, Adagio.
Thank you.
those sounds from the Marble Hall of Hungarian Radio in Budapest in 2009. Harpsichordist Zsolt Bolog, violinist Daniel Popp, and cellist György Deák in Haydn's keyboard trio number 7 in G, Hoboken number 41, despite the high Hoboken number, it's earlier Haydn from 1760 or thereabouts. As is the next Haydn trio they play, the slightly severe neo-baroque G minor number 1 in Hoboken's catalogue.
Thank you.